This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, get ready. We're going to have a big hour coming your way. Rich Lowry's going to be with us. Will Kane in a matter of moments, and a lot going on today. We have a lot of balls in the air and, of course, trying to bring peace to the most war-torn region since World War II, and that is Eastern Europe. Keep in mind, too, there's also something else crazy going on today. Pete is holding a press conference to reveal explosive new data exposing the nationwide security risk to public health, animals, and science posed by an important importation of monkeys. So that's going to be carried by C-SPAN. So keep your eye on that. And the President of the United States is going to swear in his brand new European Union ambassador, because we have about 150 other nominees, many of which passed committee, who have not gotten confirmation. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
As we spoke to the president, his secretary of state was in Israel. His defense secretary was at a NATO meeting on Ukraine. America's oldest president seemed tired from directing all of this.
Yeah, that's a little of Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes covering for Joe Biden, in my view. Now we know more. CEO and owner, former owner of Paramount, CBS, Sherry Redstone, shed light on why she was so quick to settle with the Trump administration on the Harris interview. And it had a lot to do with Scott Pelley's interview with Joe Biden. Apparently, raw tapes would show Biden zombie-like. We'll explain.
Number two.
They're looking at the security guarantees. What do they actually look like? Because if you bring in good security guarantees, this allows Zelensky some options as well in working with Putin so he can settle this conflict. And I think that we're on a path to do that.
We'll see. General Kellogg would know. Impressive Monday meeting at the White House has the world looking forward to a trilateral with Zelensky, Putin, and Trump. But Russia singing a different tune now that their cadre is back in Russia and left Alaska. We'll explain.
Number one.
Unlike the Trump administration, Boston follows the law. And Boston will not back down from who we are and what we stand for.
We will not!
And they stand for putting illegal immigrants first. This has to stop. Sanctuary cities in the eye of this Trump storm, with the focus on the biggest abuser, and that arguably is Boston. We discuss all elements of border security, even a new color for the big, beautiful wall. And joining us now is Will Kane, fresh off a successful SEAL swim in the Hudson. And he looked great while doing an interview. Don't know how you got your IFB in, but Will Kane, I cannot wait for the Will Kane show today, which will be your podcast, as well as Will Kane Country, which is your TV show, right?
You got it reversed. Yeah. The podcast digital show is Will Kane Country. The television show is the Will Kane Show. It's all very confusing.
When did you separate them?
More Will Kane. It's like a month or two ago. They said, hey, they both have the same name. They were both named the Will Kane Show. We find that confusing for the consumer. I said, I think that you're right. And then, of course, we put together a massive focus group internally and batted about 10 names, and we landed on Will Kane Country.
And right. I like your promo. How long did you shoot that?
The other day, was it last night? I was sitting there watching television, Brian, and I was watching the brand new Jerry Jones Dallas Cowboys docuseries on Netflix, which is really incredible and basically an homage to Jerry's ego. And my phone rings, and it says, Stephen A. Smith. And I go, what is this? He doesn't call all that often. And I answered it, and all I heard was just laughing and going on and carrying it about that he had just seen the promo. One man, two ads. He said, and then you put your feet up on the desk with your cowboy boots. Oh, man, it's the best.
So he was mocking you, but yet a little bit of jealousy, perhaps, because there's only one Stephen A. Smith.
I think that's the exact right recipe, Ryan. Mocking me with a little bit of jealousy.
Right. And you guys, of course, had years on ESPN together, and you had him on one of your first guests. So, Will, before we get into what's going on in the world, you're going to be talking about that on both your shows, with both your hats. Saturday night, coming up at 7:30 local time, that's 8:30 Eastern time, on Fox Nation, you're going to be streaming History, Liberty, and Laughs. you on stage. Now, most of your stuff is unscripted. Your interviews and things, just your intros are written. But I'm bringing you to something you really haven't done before. Am I correct?
Yeah, as far as I understand it, you and I spoke on the phone yesterday. I'm going to be in a little bit of a Saturday Night Live environment. I'm going to be placed into scripted situations, but I will be unscripted. And it's going to be a first for me. I get to riff about whatever the scene and moment that we are creating entails. And that's pretty dangerous on your part.
Right. We're going back in history because we're going to teach America to love our country's history again. Is it possible, Will?
Absolutely. I think we're in a renaissance of patriotism and love of America. I think there's always going to be dark corners, but you just spend a weekend like you just suggested I did, Brian, where, you know, I'm surrounded by 300 patriots swimming across the rivers of the Hudson, doing pull-ups and push-ups, American flags, bagpipes, and New York Fire Department vehicles blaring their horns through downtown Manhattan. And yeah, you'll be reminded, this country is not just great, but it's loved.
Right. And it's we're coming up on year 250, so it's going to be pretty cool. So how do you feel about in Oklahoma, for before they hire teachers, they got some basic questions on America First test. I'm sure you went over this yesterday. What are the three? And just they're basic things. It's not opinion. It's not like, why is America great? These are things like, what are the first three words of the Constitution? Why is freedom of religion important to American identity? What are the two parts of the U.S. Congress? And people are up in arms. I watched CNN last night to torture myself, and they were crazed that Oklahoma is making teachers go through it, saying you need teachers. You shouldn't worry about indoctrinating them. What am I missing?
You're missing nothing. We should indoctrinate them into a love of America. We should indoctrinate them into an understanding of America. That's what I require. Not love, but an understanding. Most of the people that hate America, either from the student side or from the teacher, they don't understand America. I saw these questions, Brian. I thought they were really fun. I thought maybe we should put them to the audience, see if I could pass. It's a really interesting experiment. You've seen Jesse Waters and Johnny on the Street. You see how few people can actually answer questions about American history. Don't you think it's basic minimum civics that a teacher should be able to answer? That the answer to the question is, we the people.
Well, I think it's all linked. I think it's linked to the socialists being elected by this new generation of Americans who are popping up in Minneapolis, who are popping up in New York City, popping up in Seattle. Now we got running in Maine. Why are young people going for socialism? Because they don't fundamentally understand what the Cold War was. They don't fundamentally understand what we're living in, capitalism, and what it brings, as opposed to America is not fair and it's not good, it's the haves and have-nots. They don't have the fundamental concept. If we get more quizzes like this and teachers start teaching the right thing, wouldn't have to worry about our future like some in New York City are legitimately worried about.
Well, they're, through their life experience and through their education, pretty far removed from the practical applications of these experiments. They haven't lived or learned about the experiments in socialism across Western Europe or the experiments in communism across Eastern Europe. They haven't understood and lived the unique historical place of the American experiment. And so if you don't understand it, either through experience or education, then you're going to take it for granted or you're going to hate it. But I do believe, Brian, no matter what's happening in New York City, I'm pretty confident we're talking about an increasingly or a decreasing fraction of America. I think if you look at the things that are said and then represented by the Democrat Party, they are making themselves a permanent minority. I do not see a future for the path that they're headed down. I don't know what the rival will be to the Republican Party. I don't know what there will always be two parties. There will always be two visions. But I'm increasingly confident it won't be the one presented by Democrats.
I hope so, because if Joe Manchin's running for president or Harold Ford's running for president, I am a lot less worried who the Democrat or Republican president is going to be, because they fundamentally, it's just center left, as opposed to way left. Will, who's coming up on the podcast today?
Brian always asks me this, and I never know because I only know what's coming in front of my nose. Here's what I'm doing when I hang up the phone with you, Brian. So this is what will be on the television show.
Yeah.
Is the Pete and Bobby Challenge. I'm headed to the gym with Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy, 50 pull-ups, 100 push-ups, 5 minutes. I'm headed there right now.
You know that RFK and Pete couldn't do it.
I know. The question is, can I?
Right. I tell you, the build looks pretty strong after I watched you on Sunday. We'll have more of you on Saturday night, and I have full faith in you, Will Cain. He's got the podcast and the television show and a fitness challenge. Not much on his agenda. Will Cain, thanks so much.
Take care, Brian. See you Saturday.
He literally is heading to the gym right now. So he was called out by Pete and by RFK. So they got to tag somebody. They also tagged Sean Duffy. So Sean Duffy, another guy, former lumberjack, great athlete. But as Sean Duffy said, I got two jobs. I'm running NASA and I'm running transportation. And now you want me to go do 50 pull-ups or push-ups as well as push-ups in a certain amount of time. But I think it's supposed to be 10 minutes, not 5 minutes. I think 5 minutes is almost impossible unless you're this elite, Navy SEAL or something, or athlete. But we'll talk about that. So I didn't talk about this with Will, and I wanted to because he's a lawyer. I am excited that the President of the United States is moving on so many different fronts on education. Everyone expected him to move forward when it comes to building the wall on immigration. I didn't expect him to seal it so quick. In terms of illegal immigration and stopping it to zero and now catching up to the illegal immigrants who have run wild here and the criminals, making great progress. One of my biggest surprises is the crackdown in sanctuary cities. And he's aiming for them. And he's flooding the zone with ICE agents. And now we got 10,000 more about to be hired. But the one thing he's not been able to do is get anybody outside D.C. when he took over, it's supposed to relinquish in 30 days, to give up on their sanctuary status. Michelle Wu, the mayor of Boston, is being targeted now. Why? Because illegal immigrants are running rampant, and she is giving ICE the stiff arm. Cut five.
To all the federal officials attacking communities that embody diversity, creativity, and moral clarity, we mayors said this in D.C. nearly 6 months ago, and I'll say it again today. You are wrong on the law, and you are wrong on safety. Most of all, you are wrong on cities. The cities that live in your minds are totally foreign to the residents living in our cities. And we are picking up the pieces.
I can't even hear it. She is so wrong. Now, if she has a short order cook that snuck in here illegally and is not causing problems, they gotta go through the normal process. She's okay with them breaking the law, coming here illegally, I guess, because she's pro-illegal immigrant. And that's the only thing you could say. She's channeling the safety and security of illegal immigrants over her own constituents. And why you guys put these crazy lefties in power, I don't know. Let's take, for example, in Boston, August of 2024, a Haitian national, Corey Bernard Alvarez, charged with raping a child under 16 at a migrant shelter. Could that person have been stopped if you let ICE do their job where you weren't a sanctuary city attracting these criminals? Another Haitian migrant, Akeem Marc Desiree, charged with sexually assaulting a minor. How do you feel about that? How about this Guatemalan national? These are all in Massachusetts. In Boston, Stephen DePaz Munoz, charged with rape of a child by force, rape of a child and indecent exposure and battery against a minor. Another Guatemalan, Jose Fernandez Perez, charged with 3 counts of forcible rape. How about in March of this year, Guatemalan national, last name Lopez, charged with 2 counts of indecent assault. An Ecuadorian, charged with more than 20 times with child sexual assault, let out. So this permissive behavior in sanctuary cities attracts criminals because they know they could stay there, attracts everybody because they know they're allowed there, and it puts ICE there because they know they're there. So instead of cooperating, you tell your police you can't. Make things tougher, a bigger ICE presence. And Michelle Wu, I hope, pays the price because last time I checked, Bob Kraft's grandson is running for mayor as an independent. And that's what you need. If you can't get a Republican in there, you got to get independents in there that I believe is revitalizing San Francisco to a degree. And hopefully we get that in Boston. But sadly, we're getting the exact inverse in New York. Rich Lowry at the bottom of the hour. Your call's next, 1-866-408-7669. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Levitt appeared to be a bit stressed out, anxious. Their eyes were wide, almost ashen at times. Those were some of the sort of images that are that will stick with me.
A letdown, I think, would be an understatement, but it's a little embarrassing, frankly, to see all of that on the tarmac.
I believe that the humiliation for the United States, the loss of credibility and reputation yesterday in Alaska was much worse than the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan.
I was struck by, obviously, President Putin was not at the table, but President Trump was effectively voting his proxy.
Okay, let me explain something. That third one, the most ridiculous statement ever, that's Garry Kasparov, the Russian chess player. So he says it was the biggest embarrassment, Alaska, then Afghanistan. Are you kidding me? People falling off planes, an entire country collapsing. You have the Taliban providing security for Americans to get out. We left tens of thousands of people behind. More embarrassing than Afghanistan, which, let's just play this out. Without the Afghanistan embarrassment, the Russians don't smell weakness. They don't bulk up their troops, head to the border, and then invade under Joe Biden. So that is some of the unfair coverage. Look, if there's commentary, you have commentary. You have a roundtable. You have a bunch of people with opinions, columnists. That's what happens. You choose to have people that disagree or all hate Trump. That's your choice as a producer. And then you have a choice as a listener or a viewer. But when you have reporters who have made assumptions, who are almost seeming to be rooting for him to lose, just like for 3.5 years they pretended, or for 4 years, they pretended that Joe Biden was fine and they didn't mind that he never came out for interviews, almost never had press conferences. They had a press secretary that didn't say anything, but that was no problem. But he's out there trying, the President Trump is out there doing things unorthodox, meet you, Vladimir Putin, in Alaska, see every seven leaders and Zelensky in Washington, set up a trilateral. To me, there's too much reporting to do to get an opinion in. But you just heard some of the negative commentary and some of the reporters. Their look on Caroline Levitt's face is ashen eyes. I don't even know if that's possible. It's your skin. If you look pale, I don't know. I think she looked fine. I saw the picture. I wasn't there. But if that's your opinion, when you're working hard, especially as a reporter, you don't look great. If you just traveled 8 hours in Alaska, you're observing a high-tension meeting to report on it with Vladimir Putin, one of the world's arch enemies, the enemy of peace and goodness, and you're seeing your president that you work for lock horns, and then you come out and you're busy and you're working, and people might look at you and go, wow, they look sad, they look tired. Fine. It's called I'm working. Have you ever worked hard in your life? And understand that you don't, I'm in Europe, some people might look at you and say you don't look good. That's fine. But am I effective? Am I communicating? If I just work, when I used to waiter, sometimes you do double shifts. At the end of the day, smell like hell, don't look great. Doesn't mean I had a bad night. Doesn't mean I didn't make a lot of money. Doesn't mean I didn't have a lot of fun. But at the end of the 14 hours, you're freaking tired. Caroline Levitt's tired. How does that fit into your report, NBC? How does that describe what happened between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump? It doesn't. And they pointed out it yesterday. And Kayleigh McEnany did this the best. And now Caroline Levitt picked it up. Calls out the press for being unfair. I think that's fair.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
You have a fascist in the White House, and that requires us. We cannot be the only one playing by the rules with the hand tied behind our backs. That old playbook, the norms that, you know, used to have guardrails on our democracy and protect all of us in this country, that doesn't exist anymore. We've got to throw that playbook out the window because the Republicans have. We cannot be the only party that's playing by the rules anymore. That's why I said this isn't your grandfather's Democratic Party where you bring a pencil to a knife fight. We are bringing a bazooka to a knife fight.
Okay, a couple of things. That's Ken Martin, the DNC chair, who's been an epic disaster. He can't raise any money. Felt threatened by that young 110-pound kid, 25-year-old, got him ousted. So Ken Martin doesn't understand. He is the party that just had James Carville come out and said, let's get rid of the Electoral College. Let's fatten the Supreme Court. Let's add two senators in D.C. and two more in Puerto Rico. Let's make them states. Really? So who's trying to change all the rules? And in terms of this, the census was the disaster. It's Trump that pointed it out. And they evidently asked, you heard Mark Penn, I hope, on Monday. And he says that they were undercounted in Republican states by 10 to 20%. So he's just saying to Texas, it's in your constitution. You can redraw the districts. Do it. And they are. Now, it's not in the constitution for New York and California, so they got to pass referendums to do it. So they're going to do it. I don't think it's going to pass in California if the polls are correct and Schwarzenegger gets going and pushes back against the gerrymandering. So I think that this, far be it for me to give Democrats advice. What you need is ideas. You don't need to be yelling. I mean, it's pathetic to where Gavin Newsom's trying to mirror Donald Trump's style of tweeting and truth socialing. All right. I'm asking you, like, are you a pundit or are you an aspiring president? Because if you're an aspiring president, you don't copy people. I mean, they accused Governor Shapiro of trying to be too much like Obama in his cadence and delivery. I thought that was bad. But this guy, Gavin Newsom, thinks he's Donald Trump, and he's trying to mock Trump, but it's not working. I don't think it's working. I mean, he's getting more followers, but does he have any more supporters? So I think this, we got to keep fighting. I don't know, you sing, you stand up, but you fight in D.C. against the crackdown on crime and say crime's not that bad when everybody knows it is. You push back against illegal immigration when people don't want illegal immigrants running around. Yeah, the short order cook who's been here 15 years shouldn't be a priority. But sealing the border, getting illegal criminals out, running down people who refuse to show up at a desk appearance, gone. You're out. You want to go on the other side of that? Go ahead. Have your illegal immigrant vote. But you're not even winning the Hispanic vote. And most of the illegal immigrants, because they're coming from the South, are Hispanic. That's just the fact. You want to go spend your time rooting against Trump as he tries to end the Ukraine-Russia war? Is that what Ken Martin wants? Is that acting tough? Rich Lowry joins us now. Rich, what are your thoughts? I mean, I don't understand that we got to be tougher. You could work harder. But, I mean, in terms of language, come up with an idea.
Yeah. Well, each side always thinks the other side is tougher. But the things floated by Carville, those are all things they would have done prior to the 2024 election.
Oh, I know.
If they'd had the power, right? If they give them a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, yeah, we're getting new states. We're packing the Supreme Court.
Without Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema.
Yeah, and they endorsed destroying the Supreme Court because there are a couple of decisions they didn't like. So – And your point about Newsom, I think, is well taken. Now, look, this may be a good tactic to get more followers, and fine, but no one is elected president of the United States imitating someone else. No one. You do it your own way. Obama did it his own way. Obviously, Trump did it his own way. So what they need is a compelling candidate in 28 who establishes the left on the cultural stuff and finds a distinctive way of doing national politics and has right. Kamala Harris was none of those things, right? Joe Biden was none of those things, but got lucky in 2020 because of the COVID election. So they need, you know, a Bill Clinton, Barack Obama like talent, you know, and they don't come along all the time.
Rich, this is what gets people crazy. And that is this: when people say they worry about what comes after Trump because it's so dramatically different from what we left. If there was a Joe Manchin on the left or a Harold Ford on the left, you know, to a degree, even a Bill Clinton. So you go, well, I didn't know what Bill Clinton was back then. I really didn't. So I think a lot of the fact that he's a moderate is because he had to deal with a Republican, a Republican House. But having said that, if you were just going center left and, okay, I'm going to spend more money on defense, less money on defense. I'm going to put more money into social programs, less. Okay, I got it. He used to speak strong on the border. We all used to be able to agree on that. But if the Democrat is to win, whether it's Westmore or it's AOC, our country would do a 180. That's the crazy thing that I don't think, Richard, you're such a student of especially modern political history because you lived it and wrote about it. If a Democrat gets elected about what they're saying, this country will get whiplash.
Oh, yeah. And this is another thing, Brian. It's been amazing to watch what Trump has done. And part of it has been he's just pushed the envelope further than
everywhere.
A lot of people would have thought possible in terms of the power of the chief of the executive branch. They're going to do that too, you know, and they're going to do even more than they've done it before. So, yeah, we will have probably the most progressive president in U.S. history with more power than he or she thought she had ever in U.S. history. So it'll be a big one in 2028. It's not too early to begin to say this will be the biggest election of our lifetime, as all of them are.
Right. So, by the way, the numbers are dropping precipitously in Washington, D.C. You know so many people in Washington. It's hard to argue against the reaction. And now people want to say he's only in the around the monuments in the white areas. That's not true. He's fanned them out and allowed cops to go into the projects, the government housing. So they're feeling more security in the area. And if you're going to sit there and ridicule the president like Senator Murphy or Van Hollen, just instinctively knee-jerk, whatever the president does, he's 100% wrong, I think you're going to look pretty stupid, and it's happening again.
Yeah, he's winning this debate. And a clear sign of it is that Maureen Dowd column, which is quite critical of Trump, of course, in many respects, but admits, you know, the crime is a problem in D.C., and it'd be good to do something about it. All these man-on-the-street interviews with the average D.C. residents, business owners and whatnot, yeah, we felt threatened and unsafe, and it'd be good to do something better about it. So, look, the National Guard, their role is to stand in front of buildings mostly, but hopefully they're freeing up resources for others, and DEA agents can go on the streets, right, and make arrests. FBI agents can go on the streets and make arrests. So hopefully what they're doing is targeting the hardcore of offenders. You know, they're like 500 guys who are responsible for about 60 or 70% of the gun crime in D.C. and cracking down on those guys and hopefully finding a way to get them in cuffs and get them off the street and make everyone safer. In the meantime, I think crime is just going down because at every perp is like, no, I'll just stay home tonight. So that's a very good thing. I don't think that effect will last forever. You got to arrest the real malefactors. But if you're a woman jogging at a night in D.C., are you happy to be running, past a Humvee and some guys and girls in camouflage? Yeah, of course.
Couple other things going on. I just want to finish up the immigration talk. I don't know what's different, and I know Rich not a lawyer, but you know, the first thing Trump did when he got into office, he says this whole sanctuary city thing's got to go. It's crazy. And by the way, Joe Biden used to say that too. So he sued through Jeff Sessions when he was Attorney General, and it didn't work. I mean, they basically pushed the president back and said it's not his jurisdiction. Todd Blanche now is the deputy AG. They're doing it again. Cut eight.
We filed lawsuits in 9 states already, and you can expect more of those to come. There's potentially criminal investigations coming, because in lots of situations, these cities are not just enacting sanctuary laws where they protect any information from coming to the federal government about illegal criminals that are here, but they're actually obstructing our efforts to do so.
So what changes now? Are we just going to go right up to the Supreme Court to make sanctuary cities unconstitutional, which I believe they are?
Well, I think that there's a line here, right? They can't obstruct federal law enforcement, states and localities, but they can't be forced to cooperate. So that's a kind of a fine legalistic distinction. And I think the courts will have to clarify where exactly that line is. But the fact is, there are so many authorities just scattered across the federal code that had been ignored by everyone forever that Trump is making maximum use of. You know, the way we had defined expedited removal, which is how most people think it should work, you know, you come across illegally and then we just send you home. The way we had defined it had artificially tied our hands, and we'd limited it to near the border, or limited it in time period in a way that it didn't have to be in statute. So what they're doing is interpreting the stuff in a much more reasonable way, and a much more in a way that tilts towards enforcement, and that's part of the reason we've had a big difference here.
Yeah, we'll see what the lawsuit says, but I'll tell you what, it's just hard to stand up against a president who wants to round up illegal immigrant criminals, and then get into the prisons where the criminals are and say, if you're here illegally, yeah, we'll take them. They'll say no. If you're just an average Bostonian and not dug in as a Democratic ideologue, you have to be saying, excuse me, what's the problem here?
Yeah, no, the thing is, this isn't like a the localities have to go along with the Home Depot raid, right? They have the people detained. They've committed a crime, and it's just not releasing them, right? It's incredibly offensive that they think they should release these people back on the streets. And going back to D.C., by the way, I'm not a fan of Muriel Bowser, but I think her attitude towards what's happened in D.C. has been constructive compared to a lot of other Democrats around the country, because she said, no, we shouldn't do this. This is bad. It's unnecessary. Crime's going down. But you're going to give us more federal resources. Yeah, let's try to make things safer. And if governors and mayors, Democratic governors and mayors around the country have that attitude to immigration enforcement, no, we think you're going too far. This is excessive. But if you can take these criminals off our streets, please do it. That'd be much more constructive attitude than what we've heard from a lot of them.
I think you're right, and I'll add something to that. The reason why President Trump is not critical of her, I think behind the scenes she's even more cooperative.
He
actually said that to me too. He's like, listen, I know what she said, but maybe she has to say that. So I think that's pretty cool of the president to get it. I also don't want to be critical of her. She's a single parent and had to leave in the middle of all this to pick up her kid at camp. She's got to be a parent too. You know, it's not like they're.
Yeah.
I know it's an important time, but you do have to pick up your kid from camp. So I'm not critical of that.
An aspect of Trump that people don't appreciate enough. He'll get along with anyone. That just the entry point is being cooperative and being respectful of him, right? Gretchen Whitmer, he says great things about, right? Because she's respectful and cooperative. That's all it takes, right? It's not complicated.
Yeah.
It's not difficult. It's not a high standard.
All right. Good point. I want to talk about Ukraine if I can, because I'm always trying to get find out what the other side thinks, but I don't speak Russian. So I'm always trying to go to the English language situations, and the Institute of Study of War made it a little bit easy for me. They interviewed Lavrov, who was speaking yesterday, the foreign minister, who does not, he's been around forever. He doesn't really speak off the cuff that'll make Vladimir Putin look bad. Oh, we have it? Okay, good. Let's hear what Lavrov said about security measures and NATO's role in Ukraine.
We have never talked about the need to seize any territories, neither Crimea, nor Donbas, nor Novorossiya, as territories have ever been our goal. Our goal was to protect Russian people who lived on these lands for centuries, discovered these lands, and shed blood for them.
Okay, that was part of what he said, and it's an important part, and not one sentence was true. You're not there to protect Russian people. You're there. You said I'm protecting. The other thing he goes on to say, I'm protecting the Ukrainians from their government, that they elected, as opposed to the one that he stuck in there.
Yeah, it's a classic pretext, right? This is what expansionist states, authoritarian states always say. We're just protecting our ethnic people across the border someplace else so we can conquer that country and take the territory. So that's just a brazen lie.
So how about this? Lavrov said he says Russia rejects suggestions that they might accept Western security guarantees for Ukraine. And then a spokesperson came out a little bit later that said that Russia categorically rejects any scenario that envisions the appearance in Ukraine of a military contingent with the participation of any or all NATO nations. So I know about rhetoric and positioning yourself, but I have not heard Vladimir Putin say what Steve Witkoff said he said.
Yeah.
And we hear about security guarantees so that people are excited. But are the Russians being misinterpreted?
Yeah, I think common sense says to be skeptical of Witkoff's interpretation. Now, it's diplomacy, so everyone may be couching their language in a way that seems appealing to the other side without actually making the commitment. But I think that would be hard for the Russians to accept, because their game here, one, their initial game has to be to try to split Trump from Europe and from Ukraine. Seems like after Monday, that's not going to be successful. And the next game has to be that even if there's some sort of deal, to be in a situation where a couple of years from now, you can take a third bite at the apple. And if there are French and British troops there that you're going to hit, even if you're trying to avoid it and risk war with those countries, that's going to make it much harder to go in again. So I think they'll do everything they can to fight Western troops being in Ukraine.
So do you think within a couple of weeks, and with just your projection, Rich, do you think we'll be in a trilateral in a couple of weeks in Hungary?
Yeah, I think that's possible. My guess, though, Brian, is to get a deal, Trump's going to have to go to another round of threatening Putin, right? I think that I'm skeptical that the initial round of talks will be successful. And I think it needs to be made clear to Putin, all right, there really are going to be consequences, the kind of thing that I was talking about that got you to Alaska in the first place. And maybe if you really think those are coming, then maybe you can get the deal. But I think Putin also should be trying to, for his purposes, string things along, right? Avoid any more consequences and keep grinding out on the battlefield and gaining more territory.
Yeah, put it this way, just forcing these meetings, getting people together, stop with the rhetoric. When you see face-to-face, he's doing everything possible. And I think people appreciate the hustle. Even though it's so unorthodox, it's hard for people to get their head around, I think they're beginning to appreciate it. And just know, there's going to be some more bumps in the road, Rich. I just worry about a Yasser Arafat thing, where you get to the point where you're all set to sign, and Arafat put his hand up and go, oh, by the way, I can't sign this or I'll be killed. That's what left Clinton at the doorstep of success. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're in the mess we're in right now in the Middle East. Rich,
hustle's the right word. Yeah, yep. Hustle. I mean, Trump has worked this so hard. All right,
absolutely.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Go get him, Rich Lowry. Back in a moment.
All right, take care.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
As we spoke to the president, his secretary of state was in Israel. His defense secretary was at a NATO meeting on Ukraine. America's oldest president seemed tired from directing all of this.
And he went on to give an interview where he mumbled through it, but not a word from Scott Pelley about his effectiveness. There was a question, people say you're getting older, but just watch me. That was it. But when Sherry Redstone heard about this and knew she was being sued by Donald Trump, because of what he said was unfair editing, and I know it, of Kamala Harris's interview that made her look much more coherent than she actually did. Because one part aired on Face the Nation and the edited part aired on 60 Minutes. They asked for the raw tapes, and the raw tapes revealed just that. She said it could get worse. If we take this to court and Trump goes after us, the Trump campaign goes after us, we'll have to reveal things like the raw tapes of Scott Pelley's interview, where we watch basically, reportedly, Joe Biden practically fall asleep while sitting down with 60 Minutes. I mean, at what point you'd see more examples of a cover-up for a political agenda? So she said, cut the bleeding, $16 million. And one of the things she realized, CBS was unbalanced. She's such a pro-Israel person. She realized Israel couldn't get a fair shake with her own newsroom. And she said at some point in this New York Times story, she thought, maybe Donald Trump could help balance out my news division.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where we're months away from electing a communist. Never thought I'd say that, but he's got a 25-point lead. I'm talking about Zohran Mamdani. And this hour, we're going to be joined by John Spencer, chairman of War Studies at Madison Policy Forum, executive director of the Urban Warfare Institute. He's also been in Gaza 6 times over the last 2 years. He's going to tell us what's really happening on the ground, including what many think, and I just go by what we're reading overseas, is a breakthrough to get half the hostages out. Then Varney and Company, we have a simulcast. Molly Hemingway's in studio. Before we get to Molly, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
As we spoke to the president, his secretary of state was in Israel. His defense secretary was at a NATO meeting on Ukraine. America's oldest president seemed tired from directing all of this.
Oh, yes, directing all of this. Now we know more. CBS's owner, Sherry Redstone, who just sold the place, shed light on why she was quick to settle with the Trump administration after the Harris interview. It was going to get a lot worse if they asked for the raw tapes, unedited, with Scott Pelley and Joe Biden. Let's just say the Mr. Journalist was not being candid. I'll explain.
Number two.
They're looking at the security guarantees. What do they actually look like? Because if you bring in good security guarantees, this allows Zelensky some options as well in working with Putin so he can settle this conflict. And I think that we're on a path to do that.
Yes, Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, special envoy for Ukraine for President Trump. impressive Monday meeting at the White House. The world's looking forward to a trilateral with Zelensky, Putin, and Trump, maybe in Hungary. But Russia's singing a different tune now that they're back in Russia. I'll expand on that.
Number one.
Unlike the Trump administration, Boston follows the law. And Boston will not back down from who we are and what we stand for.
We will not!
That's Michelle Wu. And believe me, nobody's clapping outside that audience. Then they broke into a ridiculous song. This has got to stop. Sanctuary cities in the eye of the Trump storm, with the focus now on the biggest abuser, and that's Boston. We'll discuss all elements of border security, including a new color for the big, beautiful wall. Molly, welcome back. As you know, Molly's Fox News contributor, fresh off her appearance on Gutfeld, where she did not defend me, even though my character was brought into question. She's also editor-in-chief of The Federalist. Molly, welcome back.
It's great to be here with you, Brian.
I know, but you didn't have time to defend me because he was just going after me, and then he asked somebody else a question. But I hope you don't. Molly, first off, the decision to paint the wall black. I like it. It's going to be hard. I just worry about Border Patrol touching it. I don't worry about people trying to sneak in and touching it.
Right. I don't know. I don't actually care about the color. I care about the
yes.
About the height, the width. Yes. But the color, I mean, it could be baby blue for all I care.
Don't you think it's almost hysterical that he's that into detail, that he's talking about the new party room at the White House, the new color of the wall. Oh, yeah. And Ukraine-Russia peace.
I just remember in 2016, Charlie Hurt would always remind people, Trump is a builder. That's what he likes. He likes to build things. He likes to decorate them. He does care about this type of attention to detail. We're getting much more of this in the second term, I think.
I think so, too. First off, on the drama of Alaska leading up to the drama on Monday, I saw that comparison online when you have President Trump with his arms folded, famously, and Merkel leaning on the desk, and everyone seems to be mad at him as he sits there by himself. And then you see now where he's behind the Resolute desk and all seven are around that. Doesn't that tell the story?
Oh, you think about this. Like, there aren't that many world leaders right now who are the same as they were during his first term.
Macron?
Have changed. There has been a global populist resurgence that has affected other countries as well. But yeah, it was a much different environment than that hostility that you saw in the first term.
So we have really shuttle diplomacy. Henry Kissinger, the 1970s, trying to do it. He would just fly from capital to capital saying, okay, I'm going to go there. Not waiting. They don't have the technology then we have now, obviously. You could Zoom it now. But now I like
You got to do it in person, even just for security reasons, to see how people are reacting. You can't quite get that on a Zoom. Talks are not the end of the deal, but they are a necessary step if you want to have good global affairs. And so it is really great that you've seen so many talks recently. There's a long way to go to get a resolution to this Ukraine-Russia war. But this is the – someone said it actually this week. This is the best progress we've had since the war began.
So Emmanuel Macron, one of the only leaders still there from the first term with President Trump, said this, cut 14.
When I look at the situation and the fact, I don't see President Putin really willing to get peace now. But perhaps I'm too pessimistic. But So I think it's very important to launch this process. I think it's very important we build these security guarantees. This is a game changer for Ukraine and for the European security. And I think we have to launch the process of this bilateral meeting, this trilateral meeting, and this multilateral meeting.
So here's what bothers me. Lavrov, the foreign minister who doesn't seem to ever die, says, we implicitly reject suggestions that Russia might accept Western security guarantees, followed up by his spokesperson, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Maria Zakharova, says the Russians categorically reject any scenario that envisions the appearance in Ukraine of a military contingent with the participation of NATO countries. So I think we got a bridge.
Everyone's going to have to, and if you're going to have a negotiated settlement, each side is going to have to give up something. And so when they head into negotiations, each side is going to probably give an indication that there's nothing that they'll agree to, but that they will ultimately agree to. And so if I think that for a lot of the people in the West, they do want to see Ukraine become more officially a Western country. I mean, the big problem for Ukraine, going back to the end of the Cold War, When the Cold War ended, you had George H.W. Bush's top security people just doing an excellent job of helping kind of settle that situation without it leading to nuclear conflict. The one country they were worried about was Ukraine. They were worried about it because it is this, it's, you know, sort of Western, sort of Eastern. It has these problems. And they recommended that it be steadfastly neutral in any sort of conflict with between the West and Russia. That's not how it turned out. And we do have a very bad situation there now. But if they could join economically the West.
EU.
Yeah. That and then also you've had European countries saying for years that they want to defend Ukraine militarily. And we've, you know, we've obviously been involved in that as well. So, you know, how the devil is completely in the details of what it means to have security interests protected by Europe and the United States. And that's what these this next step of negotiations will all be about. Russia has a very strong interest in having access to the ports that go through Ukraine. I mean, that's unfortunately how this whole thing started.
Well, they just took Crimea, but they'll never get Odessa.
Well, the question for Ukraine is if they want to have a country, unfortunately, there probably will be some land that Russia has taken that Russia will get to keep. But if that means that the country is strong and secure for the future, that's going to be in their interest as well.
And we'll see. So I want to move over to CBS. I don't know if you had a chance to see that story. You had a chance to look at it?
No, that was fascinating, the clip you were just playing.
So Shari Redstone has been informing the New York Times about the process leading up to the sale of Paramount. Her dad owned it, evidently treated her like crap her entire life. But when he passes away and they win the suit with all the gold diggers that were trying to grab money from him, she emerges. And she sets up her Paramount, and they're going to run it for a few years. But her turning point was she is pro-Israel. And when she saw the way the coverage was anti-Israel at CBS, she tried to balance it out. She put Susan Zirinsky in that spot to push up back on this other guy, Duffy, who's been running 60 Minutes. He says, I think we should focus on Israel. They were attacked October 7th. She couldn't get their attention. Well, this guy, Duffy, leaves. He resigns. Scott Pelley thinks he's a martyr. He's going to say it's because of Shari Redstone, but she just wants to sell at the Skydance. Now, Trump comes in and says, you edited that that Harris interview unfairly. And she said, we're suing. He goes, okay, fix it. Admit it. They say, no, we're not going to do that. Can we see the transcripts? We're not going to do that. So they sue. She immediately says, we don't want any part of this. I got to sell this thing. I want to settle it. She sees ABC settle. She goes, that's about the right amount. Let's settle for that. And one of the reasons she wants to settle for that is because she knows there's a Joe Biden interview out there at which Scott Pelley sits down with Joe Biden, and evidently he's in a coma, basically nodding off. And even the finished product looked terrible, but Scott Pelley never said a word after that.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I've actually been doing some reporting on that Biden interview. It takes place the same week as October 7th when Hamas goes to war against Israel. And first off, it's such a gauzy, nice profile that they do of President Biden. They begin by saying, oh, you know, it had been a difficult week for him, so he was kind of tired and whatnot. The type of gentle coverage that you would never give a Republican or Donald Trump. But I've spoken with people who worked there who said it was their biggest monster edit they had ever had to do to make President Biden look publicly acceptable.
So you knew about this. You've been finding out about this on a parallel story.
I've been researching and reporting on this. And so it wasn't just that they did this very nice and friendly thing with Kamala Harris, but they did this monster edit on Joe Biden. And then, of course, you also remember they had nothing but hostile, like cartoonishly hostile interviews of Donald Trump during that time as well.
So I want you to hear Scott Pelley. So they get rid of they decide to pay off the Trump administration. They're going to give some of it to the library. And the message has been sent. And one of the things she said is, in some odd way, Donald Trump could help balance out my news department. That was one of her quotes from the story, if I'm quickly paraphrasing. But remember, Scott Pelley goes to Wake Forest as the commencement speaker and just starts ripping, I guess, Trump and where we're at in journalism today. Cut 30.
Power can rewrite history with grotesque, false narratives. They can make criminals heroes. And heroes, criminals. Power can change the definition of the words we use to describe reality. Diversity is now described as illegal. Equity is to be shunned. Inclusion is a dirty word. This is an old playbook, my friends. There's nothing new in this.
I should correct myself. Susan Zirinsky came to run this with Bill Owens. Bill Owens resigned when she realized Zirinsky was there, not necessarily because of the Trump suit. But that sanctimonious tone says so much, knowing what we know.
Well, he's right in a way, right? He's talking about how powerful people work for evil. And that's what our corporate media have done for decades now. You take, for example, how CBS hid from the American people the true state of the president's decline. This isn't a victimless crime. Our media had access. People like CBS had access to Biden. They knew he was in decline. They knew he was in charge of global affairs. I mean, this is the type of decline that could lead to massive loss of life, horrific economic consequences. And by the way, it did. And they were hiding it maliciously and willfully. And they do that on every issue. It's not just President Biden versus President Trump. It's how they cover issues like radical gender ideology, immigration, right to keep and bear arms, like whatever the issue is, they're always, you know, foot on the gas pedal, helping out the left with their narratives instead of reporting the truth.
So do you think Scott Pelley really thinks he's being fair and balanced when it comes to Trump? Do you think Leslie Stahl thinks? Now, don't you think that at one point she went out to dinner and they said, you know, Leslie, pass the salt, that laptop was real. That showed that Joe Biden was working to undermine activities, under unsavory activities in Ukraine. It does show the interaction of these business practices is what is on this laptop. Do you think at any point it gets into their newsroom?
You have to imagine that if you have any sense of self, you would feel guilt for that. Leslie Stahl, to the president of the United States, said, we can't report on the fact of Hunter Biden's laptop and the contents therein because it's not real. It's real. She has to know. No matter what kind of news bubble she's in now, she has to know it's real. I mean, there's no question. There's no debate about it. And so to sit there and tell the president of the United States, like to mock him and attack him and say, we can't report facts because we're going to pretend those facts aren't real, you have to feel bad about it. And it's not just the laptop. It's also they were big drivers of the Russia collusion hoax. That's where very bad actors in the intelligence community told the media what to say. And they said, sir, yes, sir. I will do whatever you ask, Mr. CIA director. That's not journalism. That's evil, too, because the public is counting on you to report the facts. And again, that's something with globally horrific consequences. To lie about a country stealing an election from you, that's not, you know, again, not a victimless crime. It's really bad behavior.
All right. Lastly, I'm really pushing my luck, but Tulsi Gabbard came out yesterday and said 37 people lose their security clearances. We're finding out more and more information. You and I get it. You know probably more as much as anybody with what went on leading up to the 2016 election, but more importantly, after Hillary lost. Do you think this is going to bleed it all into the mainstream? And if not, and I don't know how important it is, but if not, what will it take to get it there?
Well, one of the narratives of that Russia collusion hoax was that Donald Trump was an agent of Russia. They had conspired to steal the election and that he was fighting these valiant people in the intelligence community. Now we know the opposite is true, that the intelligence community was making up this lie about Russia and Trump. And what I have actually reported just in the last couple months is that there were good people in the intelligence community who were screaming from the rooftops, you can't make up this lie about Trump and Russia colluding, or you can't use this dossier in an intelligence product. They had their jobs threatened. They were told that they didn't know everything that was going on. So the actual good people in the intelligence community are now finally being heard. Mm. The bad people, there are some consequences like losing your security clearance.
Well, what about Mike Rogers, who is at the hot top saying, hey, listen, we're working way too fast. We don't see what you're seeing. And Clapp was like, I know we're working fast. Tough. Do it anyway. I can't come to the conclusions you're coming to. So there's so many moving parts. And Trump's pushing the envelope. His team is pushing the envelope everywhere.
Well, you want to have good intelligence agencies. And in order to do that, you have to root out the corruption and make sure that people can at least somewhat trust them again.
I don't think they should be working against Democrats or Republicans. We should never accept it. Molly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great to see you. Back in a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, I just wanted you to hear a little of Tulsi Gabbard's press conference yesterday. She talked about the intel community and what she's finding, and it's just the beginning. Tell me if you think this will bleed through to mainstream. Cut 33.
The intelligence community assessed in the months leading up to that November 2016 election that, yes, Russia was trying to interfere in our election by sowing discord and chaos, but stating over and over again that Russia did not appear to have any preference for one candidate over the other. They viewed both as equally bad for Russia's interest.
So that's significant for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons it's significant is because the whole premise of them calling President Trump illegitimate is because they said that President Trump was a better bet for Russia because he was nicer to Putin than Hillary Clinton, who they think tried to infiltrate the Russian elections, I think in 2012 when she was Secretary of State or something, or 2010. And I'm sure we didn't, but I'm sure we would have loved anyone when they were trying to do elections before Vladimir Putin started killing his opponents, literally killing them. So if you don't have a, if Russia didn't do it, if they just wanted to create chaos but didn't want to pick, why would there be in collusion with Donald Trump? No. In order to set up collusion, you had to set up a scenario where Russia wanted Trump to win. Do you understand what's being set up here? The evidence is going to be so overwhelming, as Dan Bongino tweeted out 2 weeks ago, that everyone's going to have to pay attention.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Will Israel take control of all of Gaza?
We intend to, in order to assure our security, remove Hamas there. The only way that you're going to have a different future is to get rid of this neo-Nazi army. The Hamas are monsters. I don't want to occupy Gaza forever. I don't want to govern Gaza. I want to have a different governance there that basically is willing to live in peace with Israel and give Gazans a different future.
And that is Benjamin Netanyahu on August 7th. And that's what he said. I have no choice. I cannot leave my enemy right on my doorstep, who says, as soon as we can, we're going to do another October 7th. So he took out Hezbollah. He nullified the Houthis. He, along with our help, has really set back Iran. Syria has been overthrown. I'm not sure what that government's going to be, but they're not right now an enemy of Israel. In fact, they want to be part, if we're to believe it, the Abraham Accords. So yesterday it came out, there was a report that came out, and we're following up on it, that Hamas has accepted a proposed deal for a ceasefire with Israel. And the hostages, they're going to relieve about half the hostages. This is brokered by Egypt and Qatar. And they're going to get some prisoners back, but they're going to get a ceasefire for 60 days. It looks like the offer they dropped that they're now taking again. Now, if Trump didn't come out and say, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and I'm not sure this is going to come through, finish the job. If they said, you know, you better back out, it's got to be over, then Hamas knows all we have to do is hold out more, show some more fake starving kid shots. Even though people are suffering in Gaza, we have to recognize the propaganda that's coming out of there, too. John Spencer doesn't need to check the photos, doesn't need to read the stories. He's been to Gaza through the war. He's chairman of war studies at Madison Policy Forum, executive director of the Urban Warfare Institute. John, welcome back.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me back.
First off, do you believe, I mean, from what you know, do you think this Hamas acceptance is real?
I do. And we know, because like you said in the past, anytime that there has been zero daylight between Israel and the United States, between Israel's military capability, that combination of there's no daylight for Hamas, that decide that they need to release some of the hostages. Now, the divide here is that Israel, of course, wants all of the hostages, both living, the 20 living and the 30 bodies that Hamas are refusing to let go of. And Hamas wants an end to the war with them still in the power, right? They refuse. I mean, you had Qatar and 11 nations of the Arab League saying Hamas must release all the hostages, lay down their arms, and give up power. But Hamas is, you know, not a rational actor, so they're trying to figure out a way to survive longer to try to get to their victory, which is basically the world saying, look, it's, you just can't do this. Hamas needs to stay in power. So this temporary ceasefire is what Hamas has agreed to. And in the past, of course, Israel has agreed to those without giving away its national security and saying, of course, we'll end the war completely. And there are some nuances here, but because of that military pressure and Israel's about to launch, you know, another phase and to like that opening moment to go into areas of Gaza that they to this date haven't gone into, parts of Gaza City, because of concern for the hostages, but also the complexity of the urban terrain as Hamas continues to use civilians as shields.
Because, you know, the IDF is paying a price, too. This is
absolutely.
Not, I mean, they have about 495 deaths.
I mean, a total of 1,000, almost 1,000. You have to count the 3,000 wounded. But absolutely, this is the worst urban warfare that any military has faced in modern history. And despite the challenges, because one of the enemies here, I wouldn't call it an enemy, one of the challenges here is the United Nations, of course, who refuses, you know, was refusing to deliver aid to the people while the United States Israel Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is doing amazing work, was refusing to assist in the operation by actually delivering food. And that's, yes, the IDF are facing a massive challenge. And if they can, when this operation continues, they're going to continue to lose soldiers. But of course, they know that they don't have a choice.
So I want you to hear Majid Al-Ansari. He's from Qatar. He talked about the situation right now. Cut 38.
If we do not reach an agreement now, we are facing a humanitarian catastrophe. That will make the catastrophes that preceded it seem tiny before it.
And that doesn't matter to Hamas, does it?
Absolutely not. They want that. They want that soundbite, and they want the starvation. They want. They are starving, of course, the people. They are sitting on hordes of aid. I mean, during the last ceasefire, 25,000 trucks of aid went in 42 days, and they took that and then they put it in their warehouses and refused to give it out or sell at astronomical cost. I would love these Middle East leaders to actually create a solution to the problem, which is they all agree now Hamas should be taken out of power. But what? How? How do you want to do that? And they could easily open the gate to Egypt and create a humanitarian zone for every man, woman, child who is not Hamas and feed them, give them all the medical services. But for some reason, Egypt gets a get out of free pass on being able to help. And it's like the immediate solution to help the civilians. But no, they have to go through a war zone to get the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation putting themselves at risk, right? American contractors have actually been injured because Hamas is trying to stop their good work. And it's crazy that you have these Qatari and other leaders saying, you know, humanitarian crisis. You're right, but you could fix it. Like, put pressure on Egypt and create the most beautiful humanitarian zone in the world outside of the hands of Hamas in the Sinai Desert.
John, you know, a lot of people speculate on what's happening there. You've been there. And you're a war expert, military expert. So tell us, what is the quality of the military operation from the Israeli perspective? And can you put into, you mentioned the hardest urban warfare ever, considering that you know about Fallujah and Ramadi, that says a lot. So when people say they're going in there just blowing up things, what did you find?
I found the exact opposite. Of course, I found immense amounts of destruction because of the years and billions of dollars that Hamas invested in preparing every bit of the ground for war, putting explosives in the houses, putting explosives in the roads and the walls. And every step, now that I've been in Gaza four times watching the IDF do operations, and a realization that every step that an IDF soldier takes and that I was taking in Gaza, there was a tunnel, more likely that there was a tunnel underneath you than not. Tunnels with explosives in them. So the challenges are immense in just in urban warfare in general, but to go into Gaza where Hamas spent billions to prepare it for war for that moment, and that a challenge or a threat can come from every window, every alley, every street, but from underneath you, it's almost hard to describe. And you're right, having studied from Stalingrad to Fallujah, Ramadi, Mosul, nobody's ever faced this. And what I found was not only those challenges that the IDF soldiers were facing, but also the historic measures they're taking to try to get civilians out of harm's way, right? So I saw their real-time tracking of the population, the notifications, the flyers, the drones with speakers, I saw the fields of aid, right? So I went to where the American Pier used to be, and I saw this field of aid that was waiting to be delivered. So at the same time, they're facing this astronomical urban warfare challenge, as in how to find Hamas and to survive the combat. I also saw the historic levels, the IDF, because it is the IDF, facilitating, feeding the enemy's population, providing medical services, standing up field hospitals, all of that. So it's so contrary to all the misinformation we hear from, you know, international humanitarian groups or even the news organizations.
So it's pretty amazing. Do you think if I was to interview random Gaza residents, that they would look at Hamas as saviors or the IDF more positively?
So you could go in, and you could go into like southern Rafah, where there is Hamas-free zones. You have clans who don't love America, don't love Israel, but they hate Hamas, and they have created like Hamas-free zones. I mean, if you go to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, you'll of course get that. People who hate Hamas love what the United States and Israel are doing to help try to get them free food, right? When they say, like, I've never gotten free food. And this is what most people won't even acknowledge, that anything that is sold in Gaza is aid that it was taken and then sold to the people, and then Hamas gets their tax of that. Yes, but this is a radicalized population. You have to give that. And as a war analyst, I have to tell people, like, you know, that de-radicalization that is necessary as well happens after Hamas is defeated. And that's what you see with the prime minister saying, like, we got to take Hamas out of power, and then we'll get to the day after and building all of everything to include de-radicalizing.
But John, you've always made so much sense throughout this process. I can't believe how many people have jumped off Israel's side. They don't understand that this group in 3 years will be doing this again. And then how responsible will Prime Minister Netanyahu look? You left them intact to attack again. And thanks so much for continuing to tell us the facts, because you've been there. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. When we come back, we do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. Then I'll squeeze in some calls on the back end. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Big hour. Don't move.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, right before we simulcast, just a quick note. I haven't talked much about it today, but the gerrymandering will begin in Texas. They're going to have a vote about redistricting. There's enough Democrats there. They slept overnight. I'm not really sure why in the state house. We're going to get a police escort back to their house, but they decide to stay there at the state house, and they're outnumbered. So there's going to be redistricting in Texas. They're going to squeeze out at least 5, maybe 8 more seats. And what people have said is, you look at the census, it's a mess. It undercounted, it overcounted at illegal immigrants in mostly blue cities and undercounted Republicans. So let's listen in.
Great day and time for Brian Kilmeade. It's 10:51 Eastern. That shows it's Brian time. Brian, good to see you. Thank you for being here. Let's get into it. Attorney General Pam Bondi gave Boston a deadline to comply with federal immigration law. Mayor Michelle Wu is refusing. Listen.
Stop attacking our cities to hide your administration's failures.
Yeah.
Unlike the Trump administration, Boston follows the law. And Boston will not back down from who we are and what we stand for. We will not back away from our community that has made us the safest major city in the country.
All right, Brian, one more. You just got to watch how they protested ICE during the press conference, and then I'll let you go. Roll it.
Everybody, hoo-hoo-yah. Hoo-hoo-yah. El Flauti.
So, Brian, maybe it goes down in some parts of Boston, but are, generally speaking, the American people going to be swayed by this?
Number one, are you just stereotyping all legal immigrants like mariachi bands, which means you think they're all Hispanics? I don't think it's right to categorize and polarize people that way. Number one, Michelle Wu doesn't understand how embarrassing she is and how emblematic she is of almost every Democratic mayor. Clueless that the average citizen feels as though it's not okay for their tax dollars to go to illegals, especially illegal criminals. And I could roll off about seven criminals, mostly child predators, that are running around Boston, many of which have been let out multiple times because Michelle Wu is running that city. And I didn't even mention they have found, Chuck Grassley has found 11,000 unaccompanied minors during the Biden years who were let off with people who didn't have FBI background checks, not relatives, not parents, let out. So essentially, most of those kids are lost in our system. And those people, who knows who showed up to get them? And sadly, they might be part of child trafficking. This is all part of the mindset. But David, what worries me is the president sued the first time in 2017 to get rid of sanctuary cities. The court stopped them. I want to know, I'm not a lawyer, what's changing now? Because that's what the president says. These sanctuary cities are being nine lawsuits. Sanctuary cities got to stop, but the courts don't seem to be on the president's side.
Yeah. All right. Next one, Brian. President Trump says he's going to target the Smithsonian museums with the same playbook he used to take on Columbia and Harvard. What do you think about this, his attacks on the DEI nature of many of our national museums?
There's some elements I absolutely love that the president's taking advantage of. For example, there's a warning when you read the Constitution that it might be not good for people of color to read the Constitution, which is insane. I mean, there's all these politically correct situations that make America look bad. They need to be addressed. But I don't think we should duck anything to do with slavery. The horrific practice was not made by us. It wasn't discovered by us. But it happened here because the British brought them over. And we should talk about that portion and talk about the miraculous rise of African Americans in America and the things that hindered it along the way. That's telling an accurate American story. But there's a way of telling that story without hating America.
Right, right. Hey, very quickly, we got one more. Baltimore Ravens Lamar Jackson showing Charlie Kirk's Christian messages, putting that out on the internet. What do you make of that? Is he's getting a lot of blowback on that one. Quickly.
I know Coach Harbaugh pretty well, his coach. They say Lamar Jackson's a great guy, a wonderful individual. He might not even know Charlie Kirk, but he liked Charlie Kirk's message, which was pro-Bible, pro-Jesus. So if he sees that, he knows probably of his name, and Charlie's a very successful guy, he supported it. And I just think it's laughable that people have a problem with that. Wow, why is it that a quarterback could possibly like a conservative? I don't know. I mean, guys like Stephen A. Smith, would, I'm sure, is going to run to Charlie's defense and to Lamar Jackson's defense. The message is not vote Trump. It's pro-Jesus. What's the problem?
Yeah, you know, there is something to be said for quoting Jesus Christ. I mean, I'm just putting that out there. I know it's controversial. Brian, you're always controversial, but we'd love to have you on anyway. Brian Kilmeade, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And that's what the president was talking about, which Charlie Kirk put out there, something like all glory to Jesus. And Lamar Jackson said, okay, that sounds great. He reposted it, and he got blowback. But the good news is, about sports and Trump and everything. And I was there at the Super Bowl when he got cheered. Trump got cheered at the Super Bowl. A lot of time presidents don't. And Trump, you know, obviously called out the kneeling in 2017. And then the George Floyd thing happens for continuing to polarize things. But now there's a lot of pro-Trump people in the locker room that don't kind of like that he's back in charge. And maybe think that they fell into the propaganda of going to the cartoon image of who he is rather than what he's done and what he's doing. I'm not saying the majority of votes in the NFL in the locker room go to him. A lot of people do. But it kind of worries me a little that Baltimore Ravens coach John Harbaugh went with his family, not his brother Jim, went with his family to the White House. They said hello to the president, and they took pictures. And they posted those pictures, and he said, I had a great time. And he got blowback for saying what a great time he had at the White House. But he embraced it. He said, what problem do you have? He's president of the United States, invited to the White House. It's always going to be special. I mean, personally, I believe that he really likes Trump. But I think that any time The Baltimore coach gets invited a few miles over to D.C. to see the White House and one of the most famous football families, which happens to be the number one sport in America. It makes sense to praise the commander-in-chief. Now, by the way, the PGA, first time in a long time, they're going to go to Doral, Trump-owned course for the PGA Tour. Pretty cool. All right, listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget, I want to see you Saturday night in Dallas, Texas. Go to BrianKilmeade.com for tickets. Wins Beer Theater.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at FoxNewsPodcast.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hope you're having a great day. It's going to get better on this Wednesday. Tyrus joins me at the bottom of the hour, and Andy McCarthy in a matter of moments. We have a lot to discuss. I'm also watching the drama in Texas as the Democrats have come back to give a quorum to the Republicans, allowing them to redistrict and redraw the lines in Texas. Their constitutionally, the state constitution allows it. In response, we know that Gavin Newsom, in an effort to run for president and to matter, says he's going to do the same thing in California. But the laws say he can't. He's going to have to put a referendum up there to stop the independent counsel from who did its job for at least one term. And we'll see where that goes, because Arnold Schwarzenegger, among the many people, including some Democrats, who do not want partisan drawing up of the districts, they kind of like the way it is. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
As we spoke to the president, his secretary of state was in Israel. His defense secretary was at a NATO meeting on Ukraine. America's oldest president seemed tired from directing all of this.
Now we know more. CBS's former owner, Sherry Redstone, shed light on why she was quick to settle with the Trump administration after the Harris interview. It had a lot to do with Scott Pelley's interview with Joe Biden and others. Apparently, raw tapes with Joe Biden zombie-like. By the way, he was terrible in the interview. Can you say cover-up?
Number two.
They're looking at the security guarantees. What do they actually look like? Because if you bring in good security guarantees, this allows Zelensky some options as well in working with Putin so he can settle this conflict. And I think that we're on a path to do that.
Yep. Impressive Monday meeting at the White House has the world looking forward to a trilateral with Zelensky, Putin, and Trump, maybe in Budapest. But Russia singing a different tune since landing from Alaska. We'll explain.
Number one.
Unlike the Trump administration, Boston follows the law. And Boston will not back down from who we are and what we stand for.
This has to stop. Sanctuary cities in the eye of the Trump storm, with the focus on the biggest abuser, Boston. We'll discuss all the elements of border security, even a new color for the big, beautiful wall. I'll give it away. It's black. Make it hot to touch. Andy McCarthy, Fox News contributor, former assistant U.S. attorney for Southern District of New York, best-selling author. Welcome back, Andy.
Happy summer, Brian.
Happy summer. I know it's coming to an end. Soon we'll get back to school shopping. Andy, first off, I got to ask you, I remember in 2017, one of the first things Donald Trump did is take on these sanctuary cities, and he got stuck in the courts. It didn't go his way. There were other things he did work on in terms of border security, and now he sealed the border and he's going for it. I understand that Todd Blanche has got 9 separate lawsuits. Is there an approach to this city issue that the federal government can win on? Is there a tactic that they're now employing?
Yeah, I think bottom line, legally, they can win a lot on the sanctuary city stuff. As we've talked about before, Brian, the line here is the feds can't commandeer the state police forces and governments to help them enforce the immigration laws, except to the extent that Congress has enacted laws that require states to do certain things. So you can't commandeer them. But if they obstruct the federal enforcement of immigration law, then they're in the wrong and the administration should be able to win in court. I worry a little bit about things that the administration has done that I didn't think it had to do that is going to have a bad effect, I think, on how the courts approach these cases. Like, I think to the extent that they went after these legal aliens, like this kid at, he's not a kid, at the one at Columbia, Khalif, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, Mahmoud Khalil.
Yeah, yeah, right. You know, I think they should have taken the position in those cases that they were in the right legally, that Rubio has the power to do this, and therefore they would litigate it in the Southern District of New York or in Boston or any place else. Instead, they kind of whisk these guys away. They bring them down to, you know, courts in the South that they think are more favorable to the administration. I don't think the judges are going to like that, a lot of the judges who are going to hear these cases. So they may lose some cases in the opening rounds, and that's going to delay their ability to enforce the laws. But they have a strong position to the extent that these states have been obstructing the administration's ability to enforce the law.
I want you to hear Todd Blanche, cut eight.
We filed lawsuits in nine states already, and you can expect more of those to come. There's potentially criminal investigations coming, because in lots of situations, these cities are not just enacting sanctuary laws where they protect any information from coming to the federal government about illegal criminals that are here, but they're actually obstructing our efforts to do so.
So they're taking action. So Michelle Wu is using this as put our stake in the ground. But I can run over this police blotter over the last few months of how many illegal aliens have committed these horrific crimes. And it doesn't seem like that seems to get through the bubble that these mayors are in.
Well, if you're going to just look at it in terms of that, let's face it, in blue cities, you know, blue cities are not reflective of the attitudes of Americans across the country. These sanctuary policies didn't sort of, you know, spontaneously appear. They were enacted by people who are elected by the populations in these cities. So obviously not everybody sees this the same way. And I think if you look at it, you know, globally or nationally, the administration's policies are working. Now, you can't like expect to like bat your eyes and have everything be perfect. But if you look down at the border, it's near miraculous the way that they've changed the influx of illegal immigrants into the country, not just at the border in Mexico, but portals across the country. So slowly but surely, this has turned around, and it's to the administration's great credit. That doesn't mean that they're going to get slam dunk wins in these blue states. They're going to have to go through judges who have been appointed by, you know, if you think about it, Brian, Obama, and if there are 800 or so federal district judges in the country, Obama and Biden collectively probably appointed about three quarters of them, at least two thirds of them. And most of those appointments are going to be in states that have two Democratic senators who influence the process of picking judges. So the administration is going to run into some very unfriendly courts in the opening rounds. What they have to hope is as they go up the chain in the federal system, they'll do better.
Andy, the president of the United States brought up that he wants to get rid of paper ballots. He says he's back on that. He's talked to Vladimir Putin about it, and he would know because he used paper ballots and he cheats on every election. But here is Adrian Fontes, the Arizona Secretary of State, on President Trump's quest to get rid of paper ballots once and for all.
But the only problem with the security and legitimacy of mail-in ballots is that the president keeps lying about it. I don't know where the president is getting his advice from. It's clearly not from an understanding of the Constitution. But the clear message needs to be this. I don't work for you, Donald Trump. I work for the people of the state of Arizona. And I don't take my guidance from you. I take it from the Constitution and from the rules established in state law.
I should say mail-in ballots. So he's not going to change. Obviously, Oregon does all mail-in ballots. That's an example. So can the president get momentum to get rid of mail-in ballots?
Well, he's got to do it by congressional statute. You know, the president, the Constitution gives the authority over elections to the states, but it gives Congress a supervisory check when it comes to federal elections. There's nothing the federal government can do about state elections. The states can have, except to the extent the Constitution has some very minimal standards, the states can do pretty much what they want with their own elections. But with respect to federal elections, the states make the law preliminarily, but Congress has the ability to regulate the way the federal elections are conducted. Supreme Court's held that a number of times. The president has nothing to do with how elections are regulated. It's got to be done by statute. In fact, you know, presidents are quite intentionally kept out of the election business because the framers didn't want the president influencing that. So it's a collaboration between the states and Congress. If the president wants to get rid of mail-in ballots, I happen to agree with him policy-wise. I think it would be much better for the country, not just in terms of fraud, Brian. I think it would be better for the country if we all voted on the same day so that we had the same information when we went to the polls. You know, why we should find out, like, you know, like you start early voting 6 weeks before Election Day, and then a week before Election Day, some cataclysmic event happens that might have changed your vote. We should all vote on the same information at the same time. And the most secure way of doing it is in person at the ballot. But Congress has to enact that. And obviously, it's very tough with this Congress to get something like that.
Two-thirds you need, right? Two-thirds of the Senate?
Well, you don't need a constitutional amendment. They can do this by statute, but you'd need to beat the filibuster rules in the Senate. You know, I guess you'd have to get 60 to get it to the floor.
All right. So that's the president's going to bring that forward, see if he can get momentum behind it. But it might be hard, even though it would be just. And he brought up the study that Jimmy Carter co-authored that said mail-in ballots are a recipe for corruption, because he was doing that around the world for a long time. The other thing we're looking at, as Texas is getting set to vote on redistricting in that state, Gavin Newsom says, I'm ready to fight you. Listen.
We need to disabuse ourselves of the way things have been done. It's not good enough to just hold hands, have a candlelight vigil, and talk about the way the world should be. We have got to recognize the cards that have been dealt. And we have got to meet fire with fire.
He is an expert on fire, so I'll give him that. And he does know how to get it going, just not put it out. So your reaction to what California's got to do, they got to go get a referendum to put on hold their law that had them going with an independent counsel to district, correct?
Yeah, I don't think, Brian, this is one of those many issues that we have, and we're going to get a lot more as we get closer to the next election cycles, where you get a divide between law and politics. So it seems to me that what Newsom wants to do is, legally speaking, it contravenes California law. It's also a loser for Democrats nationally, because the Democrats have played the jerry-rigging game about as much as you can. So they've squeezed out about everything they can squeeze out, whereas there's a lot of room for Republicans to run in a number of states. So if they want to throw down and do this redistricting thing, overall, they're going to lose. I think that, you know, the Wall Street Journal, if I'm remembering right, a couple of days ago said maybe 10, 15 seats the Republicans would, if we really do this nationally, the Republicans are going to win by a wide margin. But the immediate interest that Newsom has is he wants to run for president. And people who want to run for president in the Democratic Party are pulled way to the left. We've seen this in a number of cycles. It helps Newsom politically to take on the mantle of being the guy who's combating Trump over districting and is taking a leadership role in these issues. That doesn't mean it's nationally a smart political move or that it's a wise legal move, but I think it helps him in progressive Democratic politics.
Andy McCarthy, our guest. Andy, I got to ask you, too, the other thing I'd love to see happen is not count illegal immigrants as part of the part of the census. What are the chances of us that happening?
Again, I think that would have to be done by statute. And it's very hard to move things. You know, look, the sad reality in this country is we have one party that wants to regulate, I think, in a sensible way, immigration in the United States, and we have another party whose position is that we shouldn't have borders. And like most issues that we have in the United States, both sides have some conception of the national interest at stake, and you can find some room for compromise. I just don't see how there's this compromise on an issue when one side doesn't think the United States should even have borders.
I know you're trying to be a little pragmatic in saying that, but you're 100% right. Lastly, this is a little opinion, a little legal. What you see happen in D.C. right now, you know, the thought in the beginning was Donald Trump's doing it to distract. I heard people say from the Epstein files, which, by the way, we're not even talking about. No one's talking about it. They're doing an investigation. That's on a separate track. But then they said, well, he's not going into the bad areas. Well, that's not true. So now you have a situation where the National Guard is there. Then you have the FBI who bulked up numbers there, about 120, 130 patrolling. Now you have other National Guardsmen out. And now the cops, who are about 1,000 cops short, are fanned out to the government projects and things like that in these trouble areas. And the results are pretty astoundingly good. Right. What do you think we learn from this?
Well, I think hopefully we learn what we had already reason to know, which is that the record low drive to record low crime in the United States that began in around 1991 and continued beyond around 2015. So you had a generation of record low crime. We know what caused that. It wasn't like a miracle from the sky. Yeah. It was a particular kind of intelligence-based, very present policing. Which included like broken window strategy and that kind of stuff. There's no mystery to this. We know what works. And what we've done in the last decade is go back to the same progressive policies that were that really have their birth and in the 60s and 70s.
So hopefully this is the beginning of waking up out of that. Andy, I know you're a law and order guy. Andy McCarthy, thanks so much. Check out his column about Trump and the mail-in ballots. Bad news for Trump, but we agree with the sentiment. Andy McCarthy, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
When it comes to security, they're willing to put people on the ground. We're willing to help them with things, especially probably if you talk about by air, because there's nobody has the kind of stuff we have. Really, they don't have. But I don't think it's going to be a problem.
I'm going to talk more about this on the other side. But what the president was saying there is when it comes to Ukraine and security guarantees, it looks like some of our NATO allies are going to put troops on the ground. He says, we're not going to put troops on the ground, but we'll provide the air attacks, the air cover. Should the Russians go to invade, should they come to a peace agreement, and they're not going for a ceasefire, they're going for a peace agreement with Russia. Now, what I mentioned before is that Lavrov, the foreign minister forever, since really Putin took over in prior Yeltsin's days, he came out and says, I've never okayed, and we have never okayed Ukraine having international troops or NATO member troops on the ground in their country. And then he went over to say, basically, Ukraine is, I'm there to protect Ukrainians from their corrupt government, which we all know how ridiculous that is. That government was elected and he still got 58% approval rating. So you can't believe anything the Russians are saying. And then Lavrov to go on television knowing they were going to cover it and we have sound from it is crazy. Unless they're doing it without telling Vladimir Putin, which I didn't believe it the minute I said it. I can't give the devil's advocate side of that. We come back. Tyrus joins us in studio and so much more. Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Levitt appeared to be a bit stressed out, anxious. Their eyes were wide, almost ashen at times. Those were some of the sort of images that are going to, that I'm going to stick, that will stick with me.
A letdown, I think, would be an understatement, but it's a little embarrassing, frankly, to see all of that on the tarmac.
I believe that the humiliation for the United States, the loss of credibility and reputation yesterday in Alaska was much worse than the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan.
I was struck by, obviously, President Putin was not at the table, but President Trump was effectively voting his proxy.
So proxy. So here's the deal. That is just some of the slanted reporting. I'm not talking about opinion reporting. Their opinion was Garry Kasparov was the one who said this was worse than Afghanistan. Are you insane? By the way, just how dumb a statement you made. He's known as an extremely intelligent guy, world chess champion. You got to be smart. But if it wasn't for Afghanistan, there would be no invasion of Ukraine, because the weakness we showed there and our unwillingness to do anything overseas anymore and retract from the world stage was the opening that Vladimir Putin used to invade Ukraine, because he thought he could do it because he weren't paying attention. Caroline Levitt, taking a page from Kayleigh McEnany, attacked. Cut to 18.
One thing that has absolutely not changed is the media's negative and downright false coverage of President Trump and his foreign policy accomplishments. From the beginning of this entire process, much of the left-wing media has been actively rooting against the President of the United States in the pursuit of peace. Initially, the media ridiculously claimed that President Trump was somehow beholden to Russia for even agreeing to have a face-to-face discussion with President Putin inside of the United States.
So that's right. Call him out. Make him justify it. Then if they want to come out and say she looked ashen, number one, I think that if you work all day, you fly all night, and then you go through a grueling 3-hour high-intensity meeting with Vladimir Putin, you come out, you look a little tired, I don't think that means the meeting went bad. And why that was part of the reporting, I don't get. Here's more as she points out, not only is the media attacking, they're wrong. Cut 19.
The media said President Trump was making a grave mistake by, quote, legitimizing Putin. They were aghast that President Trump would treat another world leader like a world leader. The media relentlessly attacked President Trump and claimed he suffered a, quote, major defeat for not immediately emerging with a final agreement, even though he said heading into that meeting, this was a meeting to listen and to understand how to move the ball forward.
So she's 100% right, laid the groundwork. Now she'll take some questions. And I think you just got to be ready, unlike the last press secretary, you got to be ready to defend your questions as well as the answers, because then when she watches your reporting, we'll ask you about it the next day. I would say this, Tyrus, would you even be nervous, as Tyrus has entered the building, would you even be nervous if you were a reporter sitting in the press room knowing that Caroline Levitt was going to challenge the premise of your question?
Only if my agenda was to push a narrative.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. I refer to them, they're not media, they're squealers from the book Animal Farm. They just push narratives. They don't facts. And how about asking a question? Here's a crazy one. How'd it go?
Yeah.
You know, how is the president feeling after his conversation with Vladimir Putin? They never ask the real questions. It's just, it's a setup trying to, you know, and I think it's funny they're always going after lately whether the President Trump is tired or seems off. Where were you four
limping.
Years ago?
Limping,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, limping. And well, you know what? When you don't rest and you're doing generational work trying to clean up this country from 4 years of just disaster, you're going to be tired. You might have a limp.
Did you hear what Senator Lindsey Graham said? While flying back from Alaska on the sixth hour, right? A 2.5-hour meeting.
Yep.
Half-hour press conference, 6 hours one way, 6 hours the other. He calls up Lindsey Graham and said, do you want to play golf tomorrow morning?
Yeah.
So the guy, he's 79 years old. I want to play golf tomorrow morning. Got to get up at 8 o'clock. He's not going to be hungover. He doesn't drink.
No. He's going to sleep. And I'm assuming there's a comfortable bed of some sort in Air Force One. Probably one of the most beautiful beds ever made, a lot of people say.
Right.
You know?
But, some are saying.
Yes.
That's what they're telling me.
But again, this is the problem with the media. They shouldn't even have them in the room because they already have their questions and answers before they even go in the room.
But you know what? He's balancing out the press room now. They are balancing it out.
Yes.
More. So you do get some questions like you've already balanced, you know, you've already brought stopped five wars in five separate nations, and then let him answer. And then, you know, It's just kind of frustrating, I think. And I think that Caroline Levin is taking a page from Kaylee. Kaylee was the first I saw open up that book and say, here's the questions you should have asked.
Exactly.
This is what you're not doing. And I thought to myself, this is precedent setting. Caroline Levin picked up the mantle.
Well, Sarah Huckabee did the same thing. She started challenging the media. Like, why are you here? What was the point? You could have done all this without even asking the question.
She had the worst. Yeah. She had the whole Russia thing.
Yeah. You know, and again, ask the question that people want to know. But again, that means you have to actually research. You have to pay attention. You can't get your questions off X.
So I was out yesterday. Thanks for filling in. You do an unbelievable job.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity every time I get it.
So I don't know if you had a chance. I don't think to talk about the CBS story. I just jumped on it late last night, flying back. And it turns out that if you look at Sherry Redstone, she wants to sell Paramount CBS, and she's en route to doing it to Skydance. And then all of a sudden, this Harris interview comes out, and the president says, I'm suing you. You made her look coherent.
Right.
I'm suing you. And he wins, and they said the suit's going away. No, you sue. I want $15, $16 million. So she was talking to the New York Times the whole time. She goes, just don't publish it until we settle. And they said, a deal. So what she said is, I want to settle. And she goes, I want to settle. And you know one of the reasons why? It's about 5 pages, so it's a New York Times story. So it goes on forever. But one of the reasons why? She said, because in discovery, they're worried about going back to the 2023 Biden interview. When Scott Pelley sat there, and according to reports, he was dozing off during the interview, did Mr. Journalist say anything about that?
No.
She goes, it's going to get worse. We're going to get charged more if they start going after us. Cut a deal.
You know, but that's the hold off on the story until after. What journalism worth their merit would agree to that? They're not journalists. You tell the truth as it comes. You don't. Could you imagine if I did something stupid? I said, hey, do me a favor. Don't bring this up till after my negotiations with Fox, please. I don't want any distractions. The journalists would be like, absolutely not. The people need to know. This is the problem, and this is why
dead. About the story itself, what do you think?
Yeah.
How do you think the fact that she's trying to be the mature person in the room and the journalist at CBS say, how dare you?
Yeah, no, because of course they have to say, how dare you? And then her rebuttal should be, no, how dare you? Because they're just not doing their craft. I mean, you went to school. You had to have some honor, some integrity. You want to be the best in your field.
Yeah.
And you have to ask, who benefits from this type of reporting? I'll be narrativing. Who benefits?
But can you imagine if they really don't understand that they're being biased? And with Sherry Redstone, who evidently, I did not know all this background, but her dad evidently treated her terribly. And then she had two gold-digging wives.
Great. We all have scars and bumps. And they don't know. They do know. That's what makes it.
Yeah, they had two gold-digging young wives. It didn't work out. So she ends up getting the company.
Issues. Yeah, you know, I'm saying, I was born with two left feet, and I wanted to square dance. I get it. Right. But it has nothing to do with doing your job. Do your job.
Yeah, so she was saying that she takes over, and she's like, you know what? The more I think of it, I think I just want to cash out. So in the meantime, Israel gets hit October 7th. She's big pro-Israel. And she's seeing the way CBS is covering Israel, pro-Hamas, the way we've all been witnessing.
Right.
And she sees there's no balance. She asks for some balance. So she hires someone from the outside to come in and provide balance at 60 Minutes. She is recognizing the problem. So that guy quits because how dare you bring in somebody to oversee me? And then this whole thing blows up with Kamala Harris. One of her quotes was, to paraphrase, maybe Donald Trump could bring balance to the CBS newsroom.
Yeah, you know, life is turning into Star Wars. You know, we need balance in the force. We need balance in the thing. No, there needs to be mass firings. There needs to be there are journalists out there that want to do their job. There are people that want to run a fair and balanced company. Because here's the thing. If you are fair and balanced, you will always be in the conversation.
And you get advertisers.
Yes. When you pick a side, short term, they can't see past their nose. If you pick a side, like I'm going all in on the left and Biden and Kamala. And if they win, you can carry that on for another 4 years. But then they lost, and they lost horribly. And the Wizard of Oz, they pulled the curtain and they saw all the stuff that was going on. Now you have nothing.
Right.
And that's what they have. And instead of accepting the fact that they picked the wrong side willingly, they're still trying to put Band-Aids on it. And if we could just get one thing on the president, it will all be worth it.
So here is Scott Pelley, October 2023. This is the same day he did the interview with Robert Herr, which, by the way, is the same day of the attack, this October 7th, on Israel. So cut
28.
As we spoke to the president, his Secretary of State was in Israel. His Defense Secretary was at a NATO meeting on Ukraine. America's oldest president seemed tired from directing all of this.
Directing. Number one, directing all of this? Are you kidding me?
Stop it. He didn't direct.
Covering for, right? Covering for.
You know what? You know what bothers me is that voice used to mean something. That voiceover, 60-minute voiceover, was powerful. It was truth. Now, when you hear it, you roll your eyes. You know, you just go, they have completely destroyed their credibility. And as a journalist and as a TV show that pushes news, credibility is the only thing you have. It's not entertainment. He's not dazzling us with colorful epitaphs.
Just your opinion. Do you believe that he knows that he's not being balanced?
Yeah, 1,000%. This is not a dumb man. These are not dumb people. These are they went to the greatest schools and they had all the greatest things. They chose. They're martyrs. They know better than the American people. That's the Trump derangement syndrome, is that I'm smarter, I'm better. And it's a little bit of narcissism in there, to where, you know, maybe they're just jealous because their voices didn't have the same effect. You understand that President Trump took the expert out of the experts. There used to be, who was the number one guy on foreign policy? Was it Kerry? Was the guy, you know, like, even Biden himself was considered, oh, he's a foreign policy expert. And then this guy from Queens shows up and says, hey, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. And he's talking to everybody. I believe they said he talks at a sixth grade level, which means that everyone understands him, from somebody who's uneducated to a scientist. And he basically took all of their steam and their prestige out the window because it was all fluff. So he knows 1,000%. It's a revenge tour.
So listen to Scott Pelley at Wake Forest in May, after they settled for $16 million. And he knows, he says the Harris interview is the way we do things, that the president had without merit to do this. He won anyway. Cut 30.
Power can rewrite history with grotesque, false narratives. They can make criminals heroes and heroes criminals. Power can change the definition of the words we use to describe reality. Diversity is now described as illegal. Equity is to be shunned. Inclusion is a dirty word. This is an old playbook, my friends. There's nothing new in this.
You look like I was going to cry.
Yeah, because it's projection.
You, by the way, those kids were graduating?
Yeah.
Thanks. Hi,
yeah.
Mom.
Yeah,
Hi,
they were real excited to hear that. Yeah. Again, this is what, and you can break this down in simple terms. A bad husband who's committed to his lie. He's committed to he wasn't cheating, or whatever it was he was to destroy his marriage. He will continue. See, the beautiful thing about lies is they stick to everything. You can connect anything. Diversity? No, diversity isn't a bad thing.
It's how it's
unqualified
used.
Diversity is a bad thing. Yeah. Abused diversity is a bad thing. DEI was a bad thing, because it doesn't matter what color the box is that you put in the store. It's whether the product delivers to the consumer. Bottom line.
And that's where the president got back to meritocracy.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, listen, inclusion is great, except for excluded people.
Yeah, we have inclusion in this country. It's called opportunity.
Yeah, that's it.
Best and brightest, simple.
Right, and compared to something else. President's moving in on education. He's moving in on law and order. He's moving in on world peace. He's trying to bolster up our security, get our energy sector going, and he's doing it all at once, and we're only 7 months in. More with Tyrus in just a moment.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is Jimmy Fallon inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
I do think we should all commend Brett Baer on how well he handled this
exactly.
interaction.
Do you know who I am? Brett Baer. I'm Brian Kilmeade. And I hate the cops. I'm Brian. Tell them back I'm Brian Kilmeade and I hate the cops. And then speed off.
Let me just, before you say anything, on I always say he's a friend.
Right.
I never partake in any of the besmirchment of your good name. But I will say you were one of the best sports at Gutfeld's clear envy of your success, your prowess. You know, when you started the semi-pro soccer team, I'm sure he was in his office angry because he doesn't have a soccer team.
Right.
You know, you're one of the
most
respected guys.
He's stuck on Fallon
guys.
When he could be at a soccer game.
Exactly. oh, by the way, since you didn't roll tapes because apparently he wanted to talk about the Tonight Show quite a bit. Like,
did you hear that?
4 or 5 days.
You missed a few days.
Yeah, on purpose. But when he mentioned, he goes, "Hey," and I said, "Oh, I wasn't aware you were on." Wait. Wasn't Kilmeade on? So I protect.
You do.
I protect and serve. And listen, I'm a part of your books. Look, Greg's just envious. You know, you're a good 3 or 4 inches taller than him. Your workouts are legendary. I mean, you keep a soccer ball in your radio because you work out.
Do you think that that Gutfeld's doing that?
No, he's not. He's not. He's envious, and it's sad. You know, it's sad. And let's be honest, the audience, the audience kind of laughs. You don't get the same laugh when you say, make fun of, I don't know, Jesse Waters.
Right.
Huge laugh. But you're a respected guy, you know, and I think a lot of times the crowd's just excited to hear your name.
So, Tyrus, do you think respected enough to pack the house on the 23rd in Dallas at the Windspear Theater?
Oh, they're sold out. Rafters, people standing in line.
Really?
Outside, probably some scalping. And whatnot
scalping.
Going on. Yes.
I would love to know people scout my tickets.
Yeah, 1,000%. You know, it's interesting. Yesterday, when again, thank you for letting me fill in, Alan West was on. And
he's coming.
Yeah, and he's phenomenal. He's one of my favorite people. And we got into a great conversation about Booker T. And I got a chance to say, hey, there's this great book. And I still think it's one of the best books written about that period, that time, that individual, that relationship.
But why is he not respecting the black community? I was in New Orleans yesterday, and I saw it was great. Booker T. Washington High School.
Right.
Right? I'm like, why do we hear more about this?
Well, it's the same thing was why is every Martin Luther King Boulevard one of the worst streets in the community? I think, and I can't speak, there was always like a black community. We're a very independent, individual culture. And unfortunately, a lot of our heroes are lost upon us because, and I'm just being real, when we focus on entertainment heroes more than we focus on historic heroes, that's a problem, you know, because.
Well, I went to the African-American Museum, and I walked through it, and you know where everybody was? The sports area.
Yeah.
Where they were showing the highlights with Magic Johnson and
exactly.
Michael Jordan and Will Chamberlain.
And it's an unattainable, you have a better chance of rolling up your sleeves and doing the hard work to emulate a Booker T. Washington's career than you do in Michael Jordan's career. But for some reason, we just can't get our heads around that.
Right. And now with what's going on in college with the NIL, now everybody can, more people can share in the wealth.
At least it's less emphasis on going pro.
Absolutely. But I would love for somebody to go to school.
Yes.
I just want somebody to go to class.
Yes, that would be great. Yeah, I'm here for an education. Sir?
Shador Sanders goes, I think I went to 2 classes. He went to one. Oh, come on. Well, we'll see what happens. He might have to get a real job soon.
Yeah,
thanks,
I like that
Cyrus.
Kid, though, but yeah, thanks.